Welcome to the Space Show, Bill.
Glad to be here.
Now, you worked on a very interesting project at Los Alamos and called Alexis. Now, what was Alexis and what actually happened to it in the end?
Well, probably the most important thing about Alexis was that it was an attempt to tear up the rules of the space business, start afresh, see what could really be done to reduce the time, to reduce the cost of taking objects to space. We, like a lot of space scientists, were frustrated. In the case of Alexis, we had a couple instruments that we wanted to fly. I'll tell you more about those later. But getting them to space is a long and painful and costly process. We had, for instance, tried to fly fairly simple instruments on the space shuttle before, and the time duration between when these ideas were proposed and when they were flown was, I think our worst example was 11 years. And that is not an acceptable technology cycle.
That's pretty well the working life of a scientist, isn't it?
It's a good fraction. And if you take the really big ideas, like the space telescope Hubble, it is a working life. Hubble is an early 60s idea. It's flown and working now, working well for the first time in 1993, 30 years. There are a few scientists that have been productive for that long, but you can't count on that. A person gets their degree and becomes an independent scientist in their early 30s, retire in their early 60s, that's it. And if we compare this situation to rapidly advancing fields of technology like computer science, their ideas are translated into experiments and results and new ideas with a time scale of a few months. That's how you make progress in the most exciting fields of science today. So where is space science going to be if we keep working on a 10-year time scale? I think the answer is it won't be very far, much farther along, decades down the line than it is now. So how do you get around that? The way we chose to do it at Los Alamos was to build our own small satellite, take advantage of a program that we ran ourselves without external requirements for paperwork and documentation, and to take advantage of the modern technologies which are on the market, which let you do a lot in a little bit. That's where Alexis sprang from. It was on the experimental side, it was a set of very wide field X-ray soft X-ray telescopes, and a broadband radio instrument called Blackbeard, which looks at flashes of radiation emanating from near the Earth and coming up through the ionosphere, which digitizes these signals at a very high rate, so it can look at a large piece of the radio spectrum simultaneously and look at how these signals are affected by the ionosphere. We were fast. We took Alexis from the first idea stage, our preliminary design review, to being ready for launch in exactly, well, just over 3 years. And in fact, that was the time not just to build the satellite, but to invent the instruments, to test the ideas, then to build the instruments and build the satellite and test it and ready it for launch. And this was done with a total price tag, launch ready, of about $17 million U.S., which in the space business is almost ludicrously low. It was our first try at a satellite. We had our triumphs, and we had our tragedies and mistakes.
Now, that pretty well puts you back in the category of the late 1950s and early, during the 60s, when, projects were done in, almost months, certainly within a year or two, weren't they?
Yeah. Of course, a lot of those satellites carried simple instruments because the discoveries were out there waiting to be made. Van Allen and his team could take a simple Geiger counter and put it in a satellite, and just the count rate from that Geiger counter as the satellite went around the Earth allowed us for the first time to map out the Van Allen belts. Simple experiments, big results. We have to be a bit more sophisticated now. That means that we need experiments with higher data rates, especially more sophisticated pointing. But this sort of capability is now possible in a small package. The Alexis spacecraft bus, for instance, that part that supported the Alexis instruments, weighed about 45 kilograms, took only 10 watts of power, and was able to store a gigabit of data on board. That means that our instruments could pour out data at more than 10 kilobits a second, and we could store all those data for the better part of a day and do our tracking from our own ground station. That's part of simplifying the space business. No TDRS, no military networks of stations. We did it all ourselves. And the Alexis tracking was and continues to be done by a 2-meter dish on the roof of the physics building at Los Alamos. We track the satellite a few times a day. When it comes over, it dumps its data at 3/4 of a megabit a second.
Yeah, I hear you saying you did all, you know, you've got getting all the data and so on, but that nearly didn't happen. What actually, when did you launch the satellite?
We launched the satellite in April of 1993.
And it flew on a rather unusual vehicle, didn't it?
And it flew in a new rocket called Pegasus. It was new in the sense that it was going up for the fourth time with Alexis. Pegasus is a winged vehicle, which is flown by dropping it from an airplane. The airplane is up at jet aircraft altitude, 40-odd thousand feet, 13 kilometers or thereabouts. The Pegasus drops for 5 seconds, the first of its solid fuel motors ignites, and it flies up to orbit at a fairly gradual slope. The angle of climb of Pegasus is about just 20 degrees, like a fairly steep ascent out of an airport with a commercial airliner. The first stage gets a significant part of its lift from a wing on the first stage of the vehicle. After the first stage drops off, two more stages burn in a more conventional fashion, and your payload is taken up to orbit.
The vehicle, the Pegasus, looks pretty much like a cruise missile, doesn't it?
It's similar. It's perhaps a bit bigger. It's carried tucked under the wing like the old X-15 of space research days in the late 50s, early 60s.
Mm. So you got this thing into an orbit. Was it the one you wanted?
It was close enough to the orbit we wanted. There were problems with the Alexis launch, but they did not come from the Pegasus launch vehicle.
Mm. And then you got a little data, and then something went wrong. What was that?
Well, in fact, what went wrong right away. And we knew that it had gone wrong because on the Pegasus vehicle there was a video camera that showed the first stage separating, the shroud that covered the payload separating, and then it showed something that nobody wanted us to see. It showed a piece of the Alexis satellite, the solar paddle, flapping around loose and apparently out of control. Something had broken during launch. In fact, we had enough data, especially with that video, to tell exactly what had happened. The mechanical connections to the solar paddle, as it was locked in place before launch, were too weak because of changes made during the integration of the satellite. And the paddle broke loose during the high acceleration in the second stage burn of the Pegasus and is attached to Alexis only by wires.
Not very good. But the wires held.
The wires held. And what bit us was that the magnetometer, which determines the instantaneous orientation of Alexis, where it lies with respect to the Earth's magnetic field, was on that one paddle that broke loose. The wires carrying that signal presumably broke, and we didn't have that signal. Now, Alexis was programmed to orient itself towards the sun after separating from the Pegasus and spin itself to 4 revolutions per minute, then deploy its solar paddles and lock into a position where it kept station on the sun indefinitely. That didn't happen. The satellite couldn't control itself without knowledge of the Earth's of the magnetic field. So instead of orienting itself, it went into a flat spin, essentially end over end. Eventually the solar paddles did deploy. There was a command ordering Alexis to do that after 20 hours if it was not otherwise successful in orienting itself. And like the proverbial piece of toast with jelly on it, Alexis fell jelly side down. There's only 2 possible orientations if you look at conservation of angular momentum and some simple physics. Alexis could have pointed itself towards the sun or away from the sun. One is as likely as the other, like a flip of a coin in this unfortunate circumstance. Alexis ended up pointing away from the sun. No power fell on its solar paddles, and within a day or so, the batteries discharged and Alexis went into a dormant mode. So everything up to that point had turned out fairly unluckily and badly. Everything after that point worked exactly as planned, as the satellite was designed to do, because it was a robust satellite designed to handle a number of contingencies, and in the end it handled this one.
So, I mean, you got the thing pointing the wrong way, it's got no power. Is it going to sort of tumble for a while and get power on the panels, or what happened?
Well, space is a very gentle environment. If you set something spinning, it's going to remain spinning and keep its axis pointed in a given direction for a long time. In the case of Alexis, that was about 2 months. And we tried our damnedest to figure out where Alexis was, get some sort of signal from it for most of 2 months, and nothing came back down. But eventually what happened was the satellite did drift. It very subtle pressures, like sunlight pushing on the satellite, twisted the spin direction around. And eventually the satellite turned to where it was spinning about sideways to the sun. And the little bit of sunlight that hit the paddles was enough to start the satellite. Now, I mentioned that Alexis was very economical in a power sense. The satellite took only 10 watts of power. The solar paddles could produce 150. That meant that they didn't have to be pointed anywhere near the right direction to get enough sunlight to start the satellite. And indeed, it did. We heard first a little whisper from Alexis, and then a strong signal that gave us its orientation. And very quickly thereafter, as soon as, within a few days of knowing just what had gone wrong with Alexis, we were able to send it signals to stabilize its energy situation and to start pointing it in the right direction, not with the automatic procedures that were designed in place afterwards, but instead with a manual adjustment, which continues to this day. Every couple days we give Alexis a little nudge to keep it pointed more or less towards the sun, the way it's designed. And so, within a week into the rescue, we were making measurements with the first of the experiments, the radio frequency experiment.
That's quite remarkable, and yet it still wasn't pointing at that stage at the sun properly.
But that's good enough, because Alexis is a satellite with a very wide field of view. So it covered half the sky that soft X-ray detectors, and it was not so terribly important which half of the sky that was. Mm. That's one thing that saved us. It took a while to determine which way the Alexis instruments were pointing, because the satellite, one of the main sensors is out, the magnetometer, and it no longer is a perfectly spinning top. There's a solar paddle hanging by wires. There are some subtle changes in the way the solar paddle hangs as the satellite goes from day to night around its orbit. So, since we need to know where Alexis points to a fraction of a degree, we did a lot of head scratching to solve that attitude problem. That's now been solved. Alexis is making maps of the X-ray sky. Those are being reported almost as I speak at a meeting of the International Astronomical Union on Extreme Ultraviolet Astronomy, being held in Berkeley, California this week. And last week, Alexis was able to discover, for the first time, a source of ultra-soft X-rays, or extreme ultraviolet, what you call them is almost a matter of definition, which flared up for a day and went away again. Nobody has seen this sort of thing before. It's only possible to see something like this readily because Alexis has such a large field of view, half the sky, and the results have been reported to the worldwide community first electronically and through the IAU telegram means of communication.
Do you know where this is in the sky, or is it unsourced at the moment?
We know where it is to about half a degree, and we have the coordinates are to be found in the IAU circular. I think it's somewhere in the constellation Musca. It's definitely a southern object at 69 degrees south or so.
Mm. So what have you given alerts to other astronomers to have a look at?
We've given alerts to other astronomers. Our fingers are crossed. We don't know yet if anybody else has picked it up. Because to really understand a phenomena like this, you want to find it with other instruments and other wavelength bands and locate it very accurately.
Mm. So there's a bit of a scramble on at the moment then.
Well, this was such a fast rise and fast falling source that there was a scramble at the time, and now, in a slightly more leisurely fashion, people are analyzing what they got to see if there's something that popped up in that part of the sky.
Any ideas on what it might be at this stage, or is it too early to...
Well, I think what we're looking for, we know that we're looking for something close by, because at these very soft wavelengths you can't see very far through the galaxy, maybe a very few hundred, 200, 300 light years. So we're looking for something energetic and close by. We aren't looking at the neutron star or black hole sources, because they're just too rare and on the average too distant to be in play here. We may be looking at a binary star that has a white dwarf companion, called a cataclysmic variable. We may be looking at a flare star. We may be looking at an active kind of binary, magnetic binary, like, say, an Algol-type system.
So then this is the first time you've ever seen anything like this?
First time anyone has seen such a transient.
A bit like the gamma bursts that you picked up with the Vela satellites.
Exactly, and if there's a moral to be had, it's that if you go up and look at the universe and look at it in some way that nobody's ever done before, in some new part of the spectrum or with a new level of sensitivity, or say with a sensitivity to polarization, you find new things. That's always happened, and it continues to happen.
Well, thanks for telling us about Alexis, and it's a rather unusual adventures, and we certainly look forward to hearing the results of the further studies that you're going to be making.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be on the air.
Thanks for joining us then on The Space Show.